Harris Theater, 6 Southwest 3rd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Water is Life. Youth speak out on the impacts of fracked gas export. On Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevera Shalom in Portland. Water is Life will include a panel of youth from the Yurok, Hoopa, and Karuk tribes, traveling all the way from Northern California to share their perspective, and a video recently produced by the Klamath tribes in Southeast Oregon, in opposition to the massive proposals to pipe, liquefy, and export fracked gas through the Northwest. Again, that's Water is Life. Youth speak out on the impacts of fracked gas export on Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevera Shalom, 825 Northwest 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a group of Portlanders tells us what they saw when they went home to help hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico.
Sexual abuse allegations are settled, and they stay out of court against a world-famous golf resort in Oregon and its parent company.
And we remember Portland music icon Fred Cole. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 14th, 2017. I'm Kyle.
And I'm Annette Newell. An Oregon golf course and its owner have avoided a trial with a settlement in a lawsuit that alleges sexual misconduct from local and corporate executives. An employee of Bandon Dunes Golf Course has sued the longtime general manager of the resort and its parent company, Kemper Sports. Court documents show allegations of sexual assault, harassment, discrimination, and retaliation. Two workers claim the misconduct has also been going on at the corporate office. Bandon Dunes Director of Reservation Services Darla Hamblin was suing her former manager, Henry Hickox, and the parent company Kemper Sports. Lawyers for Hickox and Kemper Sports say only two allegations against Hickox are still timely due to the statute of limitations. They admit the incidents happened, but argue they don't rise to the level of sex abuse. The trial was going to start today, but court documents show the case was settled.
Republicans have decided to include a repeal of the requirement that people buy health insurance in their tax reform bill. This isn't sitting well with Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden. He says, quote, "Republicans are choosing to pay for corporate tax cuts by raising premiums for middle-class families and ripping away health care altogether for millions more." Last week, the Congressional Budget Office released its report showing that that repealing the individual mandate would result in 4 million Americans losing health insurance in 2019 alone, and the number would climb to 13 million by the year 2027. It also says repealing the mandate would result in health care insurance premiums rising 10%.
At least 5 people are dead and 9 others wounded after a shooting spree in the Northern California town of Red Bluff. The gunman, who is yet to be identified, was armed with a semi-automatic rifle and 2 handguns and seemed to pick his targets at random in 7 different locations, including an elementary school, where at least 1 student was shot, 6 years old. A local man has said his roommate was one of the victims, and the shooter, who was his neighbor and a known felon, stole his truck. The man, Brian Flint, told police the neighbor had been acting crazy and over the last several days had been shooting hundreds of rounds from high-capacity magazines on his property. Local police shot and killed the gunman after the shooting spree, which lasted more than 4 hours.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions spoke in front of the House Judiciary Committee today and again changed his previous statements about his knowledge of the connections between the Trump campaign and Russian agents. Sessions told the committee that he now recalls a meeting last year which campaign advisor George Papadopoulos told Donald Trump that he had connections in Moscow and could arrange a meeting with Vladimir Putin. However, he also said, quote, I have no clear recollection of the details of what he said during the meeting. During his confirmation hearing last January, Sessions denied any knowledge of contacts between the Trump campaign and Moscow. Then, while testifying before the Judiciary Committee in October, reports came to light that Sessions had met with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Sessions then admitted to the meeting but said no campaign issues were discussed. The first time he addressed the Judiciary Committee last June was an adamant saying he had no meetings or conversations with any Russian officials about the campaign. In October, Sessions again addressed the committee. He said it was possible that Trump campaign positions did come up during the meeting with Ambassador Kislyak. The fluctuations in Sessions' story have led some Democrats to accuse him of lying under oath, which Sessions has flatly denied. Since Special Counsel Robert Mueller began his investigation in the possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, several of Trump's top advisors have admitted to having interactions with Russian agents.
After a fifth woman came forward to accuse Alabama U.S. Senate candidate Roy Moore of sexually molesting her when she was 16, Colorado Senator Cory Gardner has called for Moore to step aside from the race. Gardner went on to say if he refuses to withdraw and wins, the Senate should vote to expel him because he does not meet the ethical and moral requirements of the United States Senate, something that has not happened since the Civil War. In order to expel a senator, two-thirds of the Senate, or 67 votes, are needed. This has happened only 15 times in our history. The first was William Blunt in 1797 for a conspiracy to give Britain control of Florida and Louisiana. Then, after the Civil War, 14 more senators were expelled for supporting the Confederacy. Polls are showing a very close race right now between Moore and Democrat Doug Jones.
Police in Florida say they've tied a fourth murder to the suspected serial killer in Seminole Heights area in Tampa. Three murders which police believe are connected happened in the area within 2 weeks in October. All were shot dead on the street, and aside from that, there were no known connection between any of the victims. The potential fourth victim of the so-called Seminole Heights Slayer is Ronald Felton, a 60-year-old man who was shot to death around 5 o'clock this morning. He was on the phone with his brother when the attack happened. His brother told NBC that Felton was on his way to church, where he volunteered to feed the homeless on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Coincidentally, he was within blocks of a memorial to the three people killed in October. People who live in the area have been told to lock their doors and secure their firearms. Police believe the killer lives in the neighborhood and is a tall, lanky young man. They have released a surveillance video from the time and area of one of the killings in October, showing the suspect walking and looking at his phone. The mayor of Tampa, Bob Buckhorn, has told police, quote, "Bring me his head on a platter."
And many people are remembering Fred Cole. Last week, the front man for the local band Dead Moon passed away. KBOO's Al Khan takes a look back at his life and career.
Last week, we lost a Portland music icon, Fred Cole. People a little older than me will remember Fred from the Rats. I've heard the Rats and really like the sound, but my experience mostly is from seeing Dead Moon. In 1987, I was fresh out of the Navy, living in a cheap hotel in downtown Portland and haunting the Satyricon. I remember seeing many bands there, but the first time I saw Dead Moon, I was so blown away. All I could think of is this garage punk band is Dead Kennedys meets the Ramones with a touch of blues guitar, and I was hooked. Fred's vocals, raw and unforgiving, told the truth and didn't pull any punches. Yet there was always a message. The song, Somewhere Far Away, is dark, but in some way comforting. With the line, "You and me felt like Portland rain," this line touches my soul. I remember one night they played Black September, and it seemed like the whole world all condensed into the mosh pit. This was life. This was power, all driven by the electricity that was Fred Cole. Dead Moon was known the world over. They played in Germany, Denmark, Holland, and many more places. All to fans who found their music in little record stores and came out in droves to see them live. Fred wasn't about trying to win any awards or acclaim. He was just trying to tell anyone that might be listening, you are the power. You are the difference. They may call you weird. They may call you disgusting. And some may even call you dangerous. But we are all kindred souls. The power and raw energy Fred put out on the stage was so vibrant, it made you think that maybe you might in some small way win over the suppressed world we live in. To quote the song, It's Okay, I've seen better days, but I still love you anyway. Goodbye, Fred. I'm Al Kahn.
And now it's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here's a question for our Trumpestuous president and his trumpeteers in Congress. Why are you even considering giving more tax breaks to corporate giants? First, the self-serving corporate class is wallowing in wealth, greedily hoarding it in offshore tax shelters and stock buyback schemes, refusing to invest it to benefit the vast majority of people they've been knocking down and holding down. Second, you shouldn't give away our public treasury when our nation has a budget deficit and faces huge needs for public investment, from our deteriorating infrastructure to our disappearing middle class. Third, our people's sense of equality and social unity has been severely fractured by 30 years of gross wealth inequality. So intentionally widening the wealth gap is criminally stupid and dangerous. Fourth, why would you think overpaid, overpampered CEOs deserve more pampering? They've become imperious potentates who feel entitled to gouge, cheat, defraud, lie, and otherwise run over us commoners. Consider Jeff Immelt, the recently retired imperious CEO of General Electric. Not only was he a frequent flyer on GE's corporate jets, but we now learn that he often took two jets at once. One carried him, while a second jet, called a chase plane, followed right behind him. Number two jet carried no passengers or equipment. It was just a spare, in case His Royal Highness needed it for, well, for what? GE offers no reasonable answer, for there isn't one. Immelt says he never used the spare, but there it was, tagging along behind him, costing GE shareholders thousands of dollars for every hour it flew. This is Jim Hightower saying, this wasteful extravagance cost you and me too, for GE got a tax deduction for every flight Jeff's chase plane made. Why would Trump and company reward such outrageous corporate ripoffs with more tax breaks?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The 10th Circuit Court had ruled that the city of Riverton in central Wyoming is not inside the Wind River Reservation boundary, prompting the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes to ask for another hearing. The court recently rejected that request, as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
Wind River Native Advocacy Center Board Chair Sergio Maldonado says the next step for the dispute is the U.S. Supreme Court.
I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court is going to be equitable in their interpretation, but more importantly, their ruling, the ruling that would acknowledge the sovereign status of the tribes, that the tribes have a right to monitor the air and water.
Wyoming Attorney General Peter Michael represented the state in the case and says the tribes have little chance of seeing the Riverton case make it to the U.S. Supreme Court. He says the tribes made strong arguments to the appeals court, but they didn't successfully show that a 1905 treaty ever intended to return the city of Riverton to tribal jurisdiction.
They've heard many of these cases. Is there anything special about this case that would add to the body of law? And a lot of times, if that's not true, the U.S. Supreme Court will say, well, this case is pretty much fact-based and unique to the state of Wyoming and what happened in the 1905 treaty. And the 10th Circuit, it didn't feel that it needed to rehear it.
The tribes contend that the enforcement of tribal sovereignty is a special question that needs to be debated. But Michael says the state has never objected to the tribes monitoring their own air and water quality, just whether they should have jurisdiction over the city's legal system. The boundary dispute arose 3 years ago when the Environmental Protection Agency conducted an air quality study that raised questions of whether the sale of reservation lands to non-natives shrank the size of the reservation or not. But the Advocacy Center Chair Maldonado says the heart of the debate is a question of states getting tangled up in a treaty relationship between the tribes and the federal government. He says it's not about the tribes taking over the city.
Never was there any discussion about jurisdictional issues, law issues, taxation issues. The tribes were about monitoring clean air and water.
For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
A community development project on the Pine Ridge Reservation is one of seven organizations to win a Bush Prize for Community Innovation. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt has more.
The Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation is recognized for what's being called a creative, fierce, and dogged effort to aid people on Pine Ridge. Thunder Valley's Deputy Director, Jennifer Irving, says one major effort of the group is to preserve the Lakota language between generations.
We are mainly concerned about building fluent speakers and starting with our youngest population, which is our kids. And so we started a few years back with the Lakota Child Care Immersion Program, and now we are expanding that into a local elementary school.
The award includes a $500,000 grant to the organization. Irving says Thunder Valley has big plans for the financial windfall.
We just broke ground last week on a community center here on the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation's land base. We have about 34 acres here that we're building a sustainable community. And that community center will serve kind of as the heartbeat of this area.
The Bush Prize is awarded annually in South and North Dakota, Minnesota, and 23 Native American nations in the region. Two North Dakota organizations are winners as well, along with four groups in Minnesota. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The D.C. Nurses Association says despite winning an arbitration award for $4.1 million in unpaid raises for nurses going back to 2013, the union has been informed that the District of Columbia will not certify the money to pay the nurses. The nurses work at United Medical Center, a public health facility of Washington, D.C., Walla Blagay is the staff attorney for the D.C. Nurses Association. She says nurses are dealing with mismanagement that has contributed to unsafe nurse-patient ratios in addition to not being paid the wages owed.
Our nurses are working in a very unsafe environment. Many of the nurses feel overwhelmed with high nurse-patient ratios where they're looking at quite a bit of patients with chronic conditions, and they feel overwhelmed. They don't feel this supported. This management that just lost the contract, we're not supportive of nurses. So these nurses are reaching their end. We're going to have to make some moves.
Blagay said before Veritas lost its management contract at United Medical Center, there were many issues, but the D.C. City Council was still going to move forward paying a management contract before paying the $4.1 million owed to the nurses. That contract was since denied, but Blagay says it's indicative of what labor is facing across the board in America.
This is not new to labor. We're seeing more and more of this where management companies, you see here there's a priority where it's like, okay, you have these nurses working in a very unsafe environment. You're not paying attention to them. You don't even listen to their concerns. And now you're not going to pay them, but yet you're going to give a contract raise to a management company who's shown to be ineffective. This is about priorities here and not really about the lack of certification of funds.
Public Citizen says Trump's nomination of Big Pharma executive Alex Azar as the next Secretary of Health and Human Services shows Trump isn't serious about reining in high prescription drug prices. Trump claims this guy, Azar, would be a star who will lower prescription drug prices. But Azar was president of Eli Lilly USA. Public Citizen says under Azar's watch, 6 million diabetic Americans had their insulin prices more than tripled by Eli Lilly. Public Citizen says that the price of Humalog went up 345%, and now Trump wants the guy who presided over that huge price spike for a life-saving medicine to be in charge of U.S. Health and Human Services. Public Citizen says if Azar is confirmed, then, quote, Big Pharma's coup d'etat in the healthcare sphere will be virtually complete, end quote. WIN is America's multimedia news voice for workers. Support WIN's worker news mission at workersindependentnews.com. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
listening to the KBOO Evening News. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a roadshow aimed at educating local people about our Muslim neighbors. At 6, it's Trans Positive. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be cold and wet with a 100% chance of rain at a low of 46 degrees. More rain Wednesday and staying in the mid-40s for the high. Today in history, back in 1851, the American classic novel Moby Dick was published. Herman Melville penned the tale about Captain Ahab's obsession with catching a giant white whale. The quote of the day comes to us from Melville. It is better to fail in originality than to succeed in imitation. That's all we wantin'. Stop rock and roll, everybody lose control. Everything I did it since I'm 4 years old. The air, land, and the sea, they get into your soul. And I'm like a space rocket just waiting to explode. Homeless beings on this planet begging to get in cash. Now I'm seeing. Tonight, we present the third episode of KBOO's Sex for Sale series. Is Portland still the Wild West on the sex frontier? Let's hear what Portlanders have to say about the subject.
This is the third episode in KBOO's 10-part series on the business of sex in Portland. Today we talk about history and culture and hear more of what Portlanders have to say on the subject. First, a little background.
Oregon was once the Wild West, and it still is in some respects. Is Portland a hotspot of activity for this industry? Does it have a reputation? A few years ago, the Washington Times reported that Portland's legal sex industry was the largest in the U.S. on a per capita basis. The city has a large number of strip clubs, a tolerant attitude toward sex, and a reputation as a progressive, youth-oriented place that attracts runaways. The situation seems unchanged since 2010. In general, Portland seems like a great place for the sex business. Here's Lily Campbell comparing Portland to Los Angeles.
I love shooting in Portland because people seem to genuinely have more of an openness about their sexuality and more of an excitement about celebrating that versus just the commodification of what they can do in a certain amount of time, you know? Like, I've shot in LA only one time. And it was a little disappointing because it was just more geared towards people who just kind of show up, you know, bang it out, don't really necessarily care about the content and making it, you know, super awesome.
The industry is changing fast. Would you be surprised to find Russian hookers in Portland? I haven't run into any, but it wouldn't surprise me. The trade is global. According to Dr. Catherine Hakim,
well, the internet makes it, the whole sex trade, almost global in its scope because it makes it possible for people who live in completely different countries to connect and agree to meet. It makes it possible for, much easier at least, for sexual tourism to be organized in the sense that men in Europe or America can do research on which are the best places to go in terms of which places have either lowest prices or the greatest variety of types and services and entertainments and so on. The internet also makes it much easier for people to decide to move from one country to another because of lower travel costs, and therefore to, for example, it's now much easier for women in South Latin America to target particular countries in Europe where their prices are highest.
Is there a gang connection with this industry? Here's Scott Kern of the Department of Justice.
One of the things that you see is that the gang members or the people that are involved in trafficking, if they're selling drugs, right, if you sell drugs, you've now turned those over in exchange for cash. Then you have to go re-up your supply. So you have to reach out to your source, buy drugs again, and then repeat the process.
And here's Officer Lindsay, an undercover Agent A, talking about how the Portland Police Bureau is trying to deal with the movement of the sex industry from the streets to the internet.
We've seen that the majority of our trafficking and prostitution activity is online. Most of the women are going online if they have access to the internet, and that's where they're soliciting. We had to learn about lots of different things we didn't know about previously. We had to learn about all the different websites, and then we had to try and find a way into them, which is not always easy. In some ways, it makes it easier because we can access a broader scope of the people being victimized than we could who are just walking up and down the street, and we're only going to see the ones we see. So in some ways it's better, in some ways it's harder.
Can the police respond to an ad and set up a meeting and then arrest someone?
Yes.
Yes.
Do you do that?
Yes, we do.
Now we get back to the voice of the people. We talked with a wide range of individuals from diverse backgrounds and employment situations. You'll hear how they see the sex industry in Portland and what they think are the biggest issues.
I also know that Portland has more strip clubs per capita than whatever. This is what I've heard.
I danced when I first moved here, and other places that I lived, I kind of kept it secret. You know, people would be like, oh, how come you have all these ones? You know, when I went to the supermarket, I'd be like, oh, I waitress. Whereas here, I could just freely be like, oh, yeah, I'm a stripper. So I think, you know, it's just always been more accepted here. Over the years, though, I feel like it's maybe more of a just institution of Portland, or I mean, I see lots of couples. It's you know, you go to a bar, you go to a strip club, same thing. I don't know.
For sure, entirely, 100% the industry has changed, because I do remember early 90s working in New York City, just bartending in a strip club. And I couldn't tell my friends, because that was such an, I don't know, taboo thing to do. Mm-hmm. Underground, obscure. My little rock and roll friends, sure, but I couldn't really tell anybody else. But I also started to notice that every TV show has an episode where they go to the strip club. Every movie has a scene where they go to the strip club. Things have really changed in the past 20 years. Even Friends, they went to the strip club. And this was such a family-friendly, fun sort of thing, but it's far more accepted today.
Yeah, it's become, porn is crazy everywhere. And I imagine it disconnects people's real relationships. And so without having those, people are paying for sex more on the fly. Mm-hmm. And then when porn's not available, then they want that quick fix still. And they don't want to go through the whole week of getting to know somebody. And so then bordellos and whorehouses and strip clubs are making more money that way. That grows.
Pornography definitely has. I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, I'm 35 now. So, I mean, as a kid, you know, as a young youth trying to find a porno magazine, you know, that was trying to find a porno magazine, and now I can find, I guess, practically anything that my heart desires on the internet without even paying for it, right? So that's definitely something that changed.
I have friends who aren't part of, like, any legal sex industry. They're sex workers that, you know, do the whole, like, back page kind of selling of themselves kind of thing. And I think if there's one thing, we could do something more to help those people stay safe in what they're trying to do, you know, because I don't think that, like, making it, you know, they're not going to change anytime soon because they don't want to. So I think that we could help.
If you make it legal, you can regulate it, you know. If you legalized prostitution, then you can put checks and balances in place to make it safer, and to make it less dangerous for those that are forced to work in it. With all that said, that's a bold stance, so I don't know if that's right for Portland.
I know people, interestingly enough, when I was living in L.A., I dated a nurse for a moment, and her job was to arrange people who did pornography based off of what STDs they had or what STDs they didn't have.
Oh, wow.
And that this is a specific job, you know, so they get people together and She was one of the people that kept the records on these kinds of things, and then, you know, kind of screened the actors that were going to be in a film to make sure everybody was compatible with everybody else. So I have dated somebody that's worked in loosely in the pornography industry, and I have known people who have been prostitutes. I've known people that I went to school with in middle school and high school, mm-hmm. who later developed habits and turned to prostitution as a way of supporting themselves. So I guess I've known, I have known people who have done that kind of thing.
I feel like it's an art. It's also social work. It's not just about dancing and getting naked. I mean, to be a good stripper, you need to be engaging. You need to be able to sit and hold a conversation. And over that's the other thing, too. Over the years, it's gotten way more artistic. I remember when just taking off your clothes was, you know, that there alone was awesome. But now, I mean, the things girls do is just amazing. The pole tricks, there's one girl here that's on roller skates. It's really evolved into an art form.
I used to bartend at a strip club in New York City. There were the guys that would come in, it's fun, we're with our friends, and there were also the guys that you knew had no outlet in their life. And this was a thing for them. For whatever reason, they didn't feel that they could communicate with a woman. For whatever reason. They could come into the strip club and they knew that there was an attractive girl who would want to talk to them, and they knew it was in exchange for money, and they were okay with that. And I recognized at a very young age, because I was 21 when I did that, that this was a necessary thing for a lot of people that are not quite as fully functioning in the world. I also recognized at 21, this is not a healthy environment for somebody to learn about how to be a male or a woman in the world.
This gentleman and woman, I allowed them to sleep in my tent last night. And so the guy, he comes back to the tent this morning and slaps the girl on his hand. Like, hey, we got some money to make. Some other gentleman, whose number I now have in my pocket, wanted to go have fun, have a date or whatever. So that was crazy. I suppose that was the type of relationship they had going on. So that was a witness.
We'll hear more from the people in future episodes when we talk about specific issues in the business of sex and how it goes in Portland.
A final note. We still want to take a stab at the question, how big is the industry here in Portland? We made a rough estimate that there are about 4,000 to 5,000 people working in the industry in our region, not all full-time, and a small number of them are illegal. We had service sector employment of 123,000 in September of 2017, so that's roughly, very roughly, one service worker in 25 in or closely connected to the business of sex. Maybe you might have a better figure. If so, please call us. And we'd like your feedback. At the end of this series, we'll do a full episode in which you get to speak your mind on this subject. If you have a comment or question about the series or about the sex trade, we'd like to hear it. Call the KBOO Newsroom at 503-231-8032, extension 202. And we'll hear you out and put you on the air.
Join us in the next episode of Sex for Sale when we focus on sex industry workers in Portland, who they are, and how they see the world.
Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico on September 20th. A month later, around 90% of the island was still without power, and many people had limited access, if any, to fresh, clean water. Much has been said in criticism about the almost begrudging response from the president. The absurdly small Montana company given the contract to rewire the island, and the generally chaotic U.S. government response to the disaster. But one group of Puerto Rican Portlanders decided to do something and contribute to the relief effort using community muscle. Oregon Pora Part Puerto Rico, that's Oregon for Puerto Rico, gathered hundreds of pounds of supplies during a drive in the first half of October. They raised their bare bones travel and shipping expenses via GoFundMe and sent two volunteers to the island to connect with trusted local groups to deliver the aid supplies. Adrian Mercado and Gabriela Rodriguez got back to Portland this weekend, and you are joining us now. You're live in the studio. Hello to both of you. Thank you.
Hey, good evening.
Yeah, glad to have you. How did this group, Oregon Power Up Puerto Rico, come about? This is in response to the hurricane, right?
Yes. So what happened was the night of the hurricane, one of our other main organizers, Amy Nieto, she and I, we've been friends for about a year. She contacted me and she was like, we have to do something. What can we do? And she has like a studio artist space. Mm-hmm. And so she said, we can use my space. And I said, perfect, let's start a donation drive. I'll make the Facebook page. And in less than an hour, we had like a Facebook event and we started promoting it around Facebook. For that first weekend, right after the hurricane, it was very, impromptu. We weren't really expecting much to come of it. We just felt like we had to do something. And, just like that, people started sharing, like Portland and Oregon really came through. We were very impressed and very surprised. We weren't expecting, the type of response that we got. And, we started the donation drive that weekend, and we started, you know, calling in certain people and inviting some people that we already knew to work with us. Also, some of the people that were coming to the event that we still hadn't met, they came and they were offering, you know, knowledge and experience to help us. And it just worked out really well. And so some of those people that came that first weekend just became part of that main organizing group. So it was just me and Amy, just two people. Like, we were like, we're obviously not gonna be able to do this by ourselves, especially when it turned out to be such a big event and the news caught on, and then it kept going from there.
And I've heard that it's been tremendously difficult delivering aid to the more remote areas of Puerto Rico. So what were the logistics in actually transporting the aid and supplies that you had to the island?
Well, so far we've sent about 6,000 pounds of Portland's donations to the island. We have contacts, volunteers who are also other grassroots organizations that are on the island who have been going to the airport to pick up what we've sent. And through them, we've been distributing all the donations we've gathered. And on top of that, Gabrielle and I flew down there and delivered some of those donations ourselves.
Where did you stay while you were on the island?
I got there a week before Adrian did. I was staying with a friend of mine that lives in a street called Calle Loiza in the San Juan area. It's a little more working class, lower income neighborhood, but it was in a pretty central location in the city where I could easily get around if I needed. Also, I don't drive, so my friend, he has a Jeep, and so he told me like I could stay with him and he could help me get around the island with his ginormous 4x4. And so I stayed with him for that first week before Adrian got into the island. And it was interesting because he had no power, and he did have water, but he didn't have any power. So he had a visitor's room that he set up for me to sleep in, but it was so hot at night that I spent most of the week just sleeping outside in the balcony on a hammock that he has hanging. So that was, it was nice. Yeah. But
while you were there, can you guys talk about some of the observations you had while you were there? Like what people specifically are going through and what their day-to-day struggles are?
Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty in the air. A lot of people don't have roofs over their heads. A lot of people don't have work to go back to. Already over 100,000 residents have left the island to go to the United States, mostly because of work or other family issues, unemployment. A lot of Puerto Rico economy depends on tourism and manufacturing. And a lot of places don't have power, so they can't do the manufacturing. And the tourism hasn't picked up because a lot of hotels were damaged. So there's a lot of uncertainty about the economic situation and just an overall like a sense of a new reality has set in. Mm-hmm. People have been brought back 100 years into the past. People are collecting rainwater because they don't have any running water. Mm. There is a shortage on gasoline. People still have to queue up and, you know, form long lines at gas stations to get fuel for their generators and for their cars. And it's just, you know, just life as it was 100 years ago. But, you know, with a modern infrastructure and a modern like way of living. So a lot of places are still running low on food aid. FEMA will come by, they'll drop off some aid. Mm-hmm. But in one of the towns I visited, I talked to one of the coordinators there for the municipality, and she didn't know when the government was gonna come back. And she was like, I don't know, we have about 3 to 7 more days left of food to donate to the people living in that town.
Yeah.
And that situation is not unique to that town, but it's in a lot of the more mountainous municipalities on the island.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important that, yeah, FEMA has been reaching the towns, but they don't go farther than the center of the town.
Right.
So they'll go to the main town. So like if we were here in Portland, they would go to downtown Portland.
Not like not the outskirts.
And they just drop everything off in downtown Portland. But then if you're living all the way up in the Southwest Hills, mm-hmm. and you're all the way out there and you don't have a car or you're disabled or you're elderly, and you have no way of making it downtown and you have no power, you may not even know that the government's going downtown. So there's people outside of the main towns, mm-hmm. that are like in the outskirts of the towns, living up in the mountains, places that are really difficult to get to, that FEMA's not, you know, they're not traveling up there. And it's really hard to get to these places. It's not easy at all that, yeah. you know, we showed up and it's been 2 months, 2.5 now. Because this has been going since Irma. Mm-hmm. Like, there's people that have had no power since
beginning
Irma.
Of September.
And they haven't, like, we were the first faces that they'd seen. They hadn't seen anybody else.
You know, just yesterday, the U.S. Senate was floating the number of $94.5 billion in additional aid for Puerto Rico. Based on what you've seen, if you could tell the lawmakers what they should spend that money on, what do you think are the most critical needs in Puerto Rico right now, 2 months after the hurricane?
Well, the most critical need is a way of using that aid money directly to the people instead of using that money to repay off the debt that the island has. Right now, there is a congressional appointed judge who is in charge of how the island repays its debt, and the island's been going through austerity for, you know, the last decade. The debt is something that the president has brought up as, you know, an issue, quote unquote, for the U.S. government. So I would say the biggest need is to repair the infrastructure. repair power lines, repair water, repair the highways, and to move the island towards a more sustainable future.
And what are the next steps for your organization?
Right now, we're just trying to... So we have a 10 by 20 storage facility full of supplies. And every time we start to, like, empty it out a little bit, it gets full again. Mm-hmm. So we're just trying to get, you know, a flow declutter going so that we can empty that space out as we can, as fast as we can. We have a volunteer sign-up list for people that want to help. So they can sign up on that volunteer list. It's running on Facebook. Let us know what days and what hours they're available to come to the storage facility after work hours. Pick up boxes and send them to the airport so we can get them sent out through cargo. We were doing it before we both went to the island, and now that we're back, we're starting it up again, and we're going to start shipping tomorrow.
If people are hearing this and they really want to do something to help, what should they do?
They can look us up on our Facebook page. We have our Facebook page, Oregon para Puerto Rico, Oregon for Puerto Rico. We post updates on there, pictures, videos, anything that people are curious to know. Our GoFundMe link is on there too if they want to donate. And also the volunteer sign-up list is there.
And there's been a history, basically, that has led Puerto Rico to this point that you were talking about, that this disaster didn't just happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Puerto Rico is the world's oldest colony. We've always been a colony throughout the history, whether it's with Spain or with the United States. We share the same fate as the Virgin Islands and as Guam and America Samoa. And throughout our history, we have been used as a colony by, you know, to the advantage of the colonizer. So just like Hawaii with its pineapple plantations, Puerto Rico had an extensive sugar cane plantation. It was one of the largest sugar exporters. And now in the recently it was pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceuticals were big reason Puerto Rico's in debt, because we gave a lot of tax breaks to pharmaceutical companies, and our status as a colony is what's kind of holding us back as an island, because we don't have political representation in the United States to have our voices heard. We can't vote for president. We have a congressional representative, but she can't vote on any legislation. She can just sit there and listen and be on committees.
Well, Adrian, Gabriela, thank you so much for coming by and telling us your story.
Yes.
And that's Oregon Para Puerto Rico. You can, if you want to help out at all, you can visit them on their Facebook page.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
I gotta read the closing credits. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. If you or someone you know have been involved in a hate crime or experienced police abuse, the KBOO Evening News investigative team is interested in speaking with you concerning its ongoing investigations and the lack of Portland police oversight and the year's rise in hate crime numbers. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032 or email newsdirector@kboo.fm. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Khan, Sam Bowman, and Annette Newell. The producer is Zelos Marchant. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seway, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, and you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Annette Newell. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland. At 9, on Political Perspectives, Linda Olson-Osterlin welcomes Nita C. Crawford from the Cost of War Project, a team of scholars working to calculate the economic and human costs of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the food show for people who love to eat. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate and become a member.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Pastor Terry, sorry about that. The Washington branch of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, is co-sponsoring the Faith Over Fear Roadshow going on now. The roadshow has been traveling across Washington State and makes its last stop in Vancouver this Friday. It was put together by Neela Afzali, Executive Director of American Muslim Empowerment Network based in Redmond, Washington, and Pastor Terry Kylo of Neighbors of Faith. They have been traveling into towns and cities across Washington since September, inviting people to express their thoughts, feelings, and questions about their Muslim neighbors. The communities range from tiny Port Orchard to the cities of Seattle and Tacoma, and we have Pastor Kylo on the phone. Hello, Pastor?
Hey, it's good to talk with you.
Yeah, nice to have you on the show. So what inspired the idea for the roadshow?
Well, Anila and I have both been working separately for quite a while to try to combat Islamophobia in Western Washington. And then we got to know each other and began to think through how we could devise a regional strategy to try to build a movement in Western Washington to help combat Islamophobia, to bring faith leaders together, civic leaders, education leaders, public safety officers, and help them understand Islam a bit better and help them understand some of the forces behind some of the false arguments toward our Muslim neighbors.
What are some of the main questions or concerns that people have had at these events that you've observed?
Well, you know, we hear almost the same questions at every event. There's always something about Islam and women. There's always something around Muslims and living in the United States and abiding by the U.S. Constitution. There's almost always something about Islam and violence. And in fact, after having done over 40 public events in Western Washington about this, I actually have made a list.
Wow.
And I see the same questions everywhere I went. And in fact, the fact that I've seen the same questions over and over again began to make me do more research into why everyone asked the same questions in almost the same order, using almost the same language.
Wow. Mm.
And what feedback have you had on the roadshow specifically and how it speaks to these communities?
You know, it's been really, really marvelous. We've had between 50 and 100 people come to each one. We have had a good representation from civic leaders and faith leaders and other community leaders. We've seen people kind of open up a little bit. There's sort of several categories of people who come. You know, there are some folk that are really apprehensive and are very fearful, and all we can do is hope to give them a good experience and help them reflect, you know, on this positive experience that they've had in engaging with a Muslim. There also are people who want to be allies, but are still kind of fearful. And so we hope to give those folk, you know, new information, help them understand how to respond to some of these questions and these false stories that are told about Muslims. And then there's another, like, you know, 30-40% of people who really are on board and just want a few more tools. And it's been great, you know, to engage with all three of those groups. And we've seen some people kind of open up and change and come up and talk with them. They're a Muslim for the first time ever, maybe, and find, you know, you can just kind of see on their face that that the world's changed a bit for them.
Are there any moments where you've really been caught off guard or surprised?
Well, after having done 40 of these, I will tell you that, you know, that I've had some pretty heated questions from people, but actually during this roadshow, not so much. I mean, Anila and I have answered the questions so many times, we kind of know how to do it. But I had one gentleman walk up to me. It was really, really kind of wonderful. He was maybe 75 years old, and he walked up to me afterward and he said, you know, I'm going to start thinking about what news I watch.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And that was a really cool, you know, kind of moment there. And I just said, sir, I'm very honored, mm-hmm. you know, that you would consider, you know, that. Mm-hmm. And so that was a nice moment.
And can you talk more about the last stop of the roadshow that's going to be in Vancouver this Friday?
Yeah. So we've done 11 of these. Our 11th one will be at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Vancouver, Washington at 1 p.m. And we really encourage folk to come on out and they'll get the chance to hear Anila speak for about 40 minutes. I'll speak for about 20. And then we do a full hour of Q&A with people. And then we're willing to stay afterward and meet and answer any questions or respond to comments that they might have.
Now, you're a part of the group Neighbors in Faith, as we mentioned. Tell us the mission of that group, Pastor.
Yeah, so our official mission statement is remembering ourselves as neighbors. And I really feel that we're in a time of tremendous, where we're all, you know, not all, but many of us are participating in sort of the dismembering of ourselves. We're tribalizing from each other. We're distancing from each other. We're in a very us and them kind of divisive time. And so our mission specifically to help us remember ourselves as neighbors is to combat Islamophobia and try to help foster partnerships between different faith communities up and down Western Washington, and get them into partnerships with each other so that they can eat together and play together and tell stories and basically, you know, sit across the table and recognize each other as human beings again. And the beautiful thing is that a lot of that's happening throughout the state, is that people are realizing we've gone too far toward distancing ourselves from each other, and we see atheist groups and agnostic groups and Buddhists and Hindus and Sikhs and Christians and Jews and Muslims coming together and not trying to solve all the great issues of the world right away, but just, you know, seeing each other as human beings again.
Mm-hmm. And speaking others as human beings, and as you mentioned, all the uncertainty in the Muslim community, especially when they have children that have to watch television with their government saying foul things about them. Personally, what advice do you have for people who can support and connect with their Muslim neighbors aside from pre-organized events?
Yeah, so obviously these kind of organized events are just a very, very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have to realize that our Muslim neighbors are under a lot of pressure. You know, TV, movies, the news media mostly has a lot of negative things around Muslims, often more negative than things like cocaine or even cancer. And there is a $30 million industry creating fear and disinformation about our Muslim neighbors. So first, I would just say, remember that Muslims make up 1% of the population. Not all of us are going to have a Muslim best friend, but all of us can be good allies with Muslims. And if we're part of a community group or a faith community of some kind, try to form a partnership and then go to a mosque and invite them to be part of the partnership and arrange it so that there's these kind of humanizing events and humanizing interactions. Because what Muslims need from others in this country is for us to be able to tell friends and family and people we meet the positive stories about our Muslim neighbors. Because they're certainly not going to get it by watching the news media on TV.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the MAX train attack, that horrific event that happened in Portland, do you think that that really sparked a discussion about these issues?
Yes, because what it highlights is that when we have a $30 million a year industry and the national narrative about violence, political violence in the Middle East, that leads people to be so afraid, mm-hmm. that actually decreases the safety for all of us. Mm-hmm. We actually have groups out there advocating that Muslims' civil and religious liberties be limited. Mm. That takes away the civil and religious liberties of all of us. And so what we're trying to do, Anila and I, is to push back and create a movement to push back on this fear and on this hatred and bring greater understanding and compassion for everyone's safety. And so Anila has gone down and has met some of the families that were impacted by that horrific event on the train. Mm-hmm. And several times, you know, she's broken down, mm-hmm. weeping for their loss.
Of course.
So when we dehumanize other people, mm-hmm. You know, you never know where that's going to start. Once scapegoating gets going in a society, that is walking down a very dark road, and all of us know where that road leads. And it's up to all of us to do our part to say we don't have to walk down that road this time.
That's well said. And before we wrap up, can you... where in Vancouver that you and Anila will be this Friday?
Yeah, we'll be at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Vancouver at 1 p.m. in the afternoon. The event will last about 2 hours, and we would love to see people there.
All right. Well, Pastor Kylo, thank you so much for joining us, and that's the Anti-Islamophobia Roadshow at Vancouver this Friday.
Okay.
That's right.
Hopefully lots of folks will come out. You said you've had like 40 events like this so far.
Yeah, Anila and I are doing this roadshow right now, and then we're going to do a tour in Eastern Washington. We've got more events in smaller towns planned, and there's big plans across the country for how we